Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order, the hour of 3 o'clock having arrived. Representative Bauer, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting?
Yes, I have.
Representative Bauer moves the adoption of those minutes. Any comments, questions, concerns, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of that adoption of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Bauer, and thank you, Representative Davids, for passing those.
You're welcome. Who do we want to first? Paul Anderson?
Representative Anselmo, are you still here? You are first up today. I will move House File 3158 so it is properly and legally in front of the committee. This bill, should it pass today, will be going to the General Register. Representative Anselmo, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Representative Dario Anselmo.
Representative Anselmo, I'm sorry, is this your first term in the legislature?
It's my first term, second year, so no treats today.
I'd like to move for a roll call.
Mr. Chair, is the
people
need
a higher motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anselmo, to your bill.
I'd be happy to bring burritos if that would make everyone happier.
Game, set, and match, Representative Anselmo.
Okay.
To your bill.
Mr. Chair, I am here to introduce House File 3158, and this is a bill that I'm going to let my testifier summarize and go through in detail as he works for the Mortgage Association. But basically, we're looking to do some conformity and deal with some education requirements that the state of Minnesota needs to clean up. This is sort of basically a red tape bill to help people that are in the mortgage processing and origination business. With that, I'm going to introduce Bill Choice, who will take us through the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and Representative Anselmo. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of this bill. My name is Bill Schweitz. I work for Summit Mortgage Corporation, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Mortgage Association. This bill will do two things. It will make Minnesota's mortgage originators' pre-licensing exam consistent with the rest of the nation. And the second thing it'll do is require annual continuing education that is specific to Minnesota laws and rules. And just a tiny bit of background for each of these. First off, regarding the exam, in 2008, the Federal SAFE Act mandated that mortgage originators that are employed by non-depository institutions need to be licensed by each state in which they do business. One of the conditions of the licensing is that an originator must pass a pre-licensure exam. Originally, that pre-licensure exam was made up of two parts, a federal exam and a state exam for each state in which the originator wanted to do business. Each state designed its own exam, but it was based upon content set forth in the SAFE Act and the CSBS Armor Model State Law. Over time, it became obvious that there wasn't a lot of high-level state-specific material that was appropriate for pre-licensure exams. Therefore, in 2013, the NMLS-NR launched a uniform state test, and today every mortgage regulating agency has adopted the uniform state test, except for Minnesota, and there are rumors that West Virginia, the only other state that hadn't adopted it yesterday. So hopefully this part of the bill will bring us into conformity with the rest of the union. The second part has to do with changing some continuing education requirements. Again, each year, a mortgage originator needs to take 8 hours of continuing education. Federal law has specific requirements for seven of those eight hours. One of the 8 hours is unrestricted as long as the class is related to originating mortgages. This bill requires that originators licensed in Minnesota receive 1 hour of annual continuing education specific to Minnesota law and rules. It's not an additional law, or additional hour, I should say, but rather it stipulates the content of that eighth hour. Half the states of the union have a similar continuing education requirement, so this isn't anything new. The Minnesota Mortgage Association favors this bill for the following reasons. One, it's an update to our existing law, which will bring us into conformity with the rest of the union. And two, we firmly believe that specifying the content of that 1 hour of continuing education will benefit all parties, as it will make practitioners like myself more familiar and up to date with Minnesota laws and rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schweitz. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to come down and speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody, Representative Anselmo, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I really appreciate the opportunity to find a way to get rid of some red tape. This actually came from the governor's side of the equation, not our side, so that was actually hopeful, and it's great for us to sort of see this come true. Of course, all the work is done in the House, as we know, and do appreciate that. I'll also meet my food requirement next meeting. It will be a baked good, nothing ethnic. Thank you.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 3158 be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Anselmo, you're on your way to the General Register. Representative Anderson. I will move House File 2884. And the motion is that it be re-referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance. Representative Anderson, whenever you're ready. And welcome to the committee, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The reasoning behind this bill was brought to me by a package store back in my district. And the situation surrounding this, in addition to selling off-sale beer and spirits, they also sell ice. But at their facility, they use their own water, which means the water has to be tested, and they have to get a license from the Department of Agriculture. And up until last year, I believe, or 2 years ago, their license cost them $77. But with a change in the Department of Agriculture, in which they began using their total gross sales of alcohol to figure the basis of the cost of their license for selling and making ice, their license increased in cost up to $799, and by my unofficial math, that's an increase of 935% in a year on the cost of a license. And it would just seem to be common sense that when they apply to get this license to make ice and sell ice, that you wouldn't have to include the entire sales total of the packaged liquor when that license total is figured. That, Mr. Chair, is the essence of the bill, and would stand for questions. Thank you.
Sounds good, Representative Anderson. Members, any questions? That is such a good explanation of the bill and what it does that we have no questions. Anybody else in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody. With that, Representative Anderson, I will renew my motion that House File 2884 be re-referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howe. I will move House File 2869, and the motion will be that that goes to the General Register. Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill, what this bill does is it allows the Adjutant General to provide an opportunity to members of the National Guard to hear and the opportunity to purchase state-sponsored life insurance. And I'm just going to run down, there's a description so you know what the state-sponsored life insurance program is, and it provides all members of the National Guard $1,000 of no-cost life insurance as a benefit. It also is a low-cost insurance program with no war exclusion and no aviation exclusion, which is very important to members of the National Guard. It also provides year-round continuous coverage regardless of their duty status, whether they're on duty or off duty, whether they're in uniform or not. It's a life insurer. It provides life insurance options for their spouse and children if they so choose to purchase. It's a guaranteed life insurance with no change in coverage or cost when a life insurance when a National Guard member separates from service. That's the piece that I wish I would have known before I separated, because I didn't know that, didn't take out this insurance, and when I separated, I lost all my life insurance. So I just recently had to go through all the underwriting and physicals and prodding and poking to get life insurance.
Representative Howe, we don't need to know everything.
I just want to make sure I don't leave any rocks unturned.
You're good.
You can leave some unturned.
And then it also provides $10,000 of no-cost life insurance as a benefit for new recruits within their first 120 days of joining the Minnesota National Guard. Now, that's good for 1 year. The key thing here, the reason we need to make sure that the members are aware of it, we had no new members of the National Guard apply for that benefit. And the main reason is we just don't know about it. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's the bill. That's what it does. It just provides an opportunity to hear about the program.
Sounds good, Representative Howe. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howe, I just want to verify, so there's not a fiscal impact to the state on this legislation at all.
Representative Howe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Anybody in the audience that wants to come down and speak on this bill, for or against it? Not seeing anybody. Representative Howe, good job. Unless you want a final word, I will go ahead and renew the motion that House File 2869 be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Howe. Nice job. Thank you. With that, Representative Anderson, we will go to House File 2779. Representative Anderson, whenever you're ready, I'll let you go ahead and move your bill and proceed whenever you are ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2779 referred to the General Register. Members, what we have here before you today is a piece of legislation that has been the result of about 6 years' worth of wrangling. And rather than this becoming a two lines of fishing in the water type issue, I've been trying to get the two entities together to work out some compromise. But just to look at the bill overall, I do have some expert testifiers here today that can speak to more of the nitty-gritty details of the bill. But from my perspective, I look at this bill from my mom. I have an 89-year-old mother who believes everything that her physician tells her. And rather than going out and seeking information about what her optometrist is telling her on her eye care, she follows that religiously. And I think what this bill does is provides her with greater transparency on what maybe some other options are for her. And as a daughter that tries to convince her mom about some of these things, it's always nice when it's coming directly from the optometrist that is servicing her. So with that, Mr. Chair, I want to respect your time. I do have testifiers, and they can speak to more of the details if that's helpful.
That sounds good to me. Whoever you want to have come up first, Mr. Julian Roberts. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Julian Roberts. I am the executive director of the National Association of Vision Care Plans. We represent vision care plans all across the country. There are 12 of those organizations that operate here and who have lives covered here in the state of Minnesota, over 1.6 million. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give some context to the discussion today and talk a little bit in regards to managed vision care. As many of you may know, managed vision care is a voluntary benefit. People who need vision benefits or need to have vision correction for the rest of their life realize that they're going to have out-of-pocket expenses that they're going to need to manage from this day forward. They reach out and purchase managed vision care plans because their purpose is to help them to manage those expenses. Now, part of a managed vision care plan's responsibility is to go out and to contract with providers, not necessarily on who will be paying them, but in regards to directing lives to their operations and to their offices, and have negotiated discounts regardless of whether the plan pays them or the individual pays them, but have negotiated arrangements on their behalf. Vision care plans also negotiate in regards to lenses and frames, as well as labs, not only negotiating discounts due to the volumes that are put through there, but also negotiating turnaround times, also negotiating defect warranties in regards to that. So as you can imagine, a consumer that is looking to cover their, not only themselves, but their family for the rest of their lives, have two things that they need to look at. One is professional services, and one is materials. So just to explain a little bit, professional services are the services provided by the eye care professional in that regard. So the annual comprehensive exam and other diagnostic processes during that time. It could also be fitting and so forth of contacts and other types of situations. Materials are the frames and lenses, or contacts as they may be. And the situation with vision is that almost all vision care plans provide you coverage and a payment for your annual comprehensive exams, and usually a payment toward your first set of frames and lenses. But sometimes you need more than one set of frames and lenses. Sometimes it may cover for the lens, but it doesn't cover for all the coatings. You know, there are people that work in the industry that need protective lenses that may or may not be covered. They may need a regular pair of glasses during the day and a different set of glasses for their work environment. There could be a situation where you need a pair of frames and lenses for nighttime and then sunglasses for the daytime. There are situations like my son, who unfortunately has lost four pair of frames and lenses in 1 year, and I've had to go back and buy those multiple times. So the issue is that, yes, the plan does pay for the first set of materials, but that second and third, we have negotiated on behalf of the consumer with the optometrist to be able to provide discounts to the patients in regards to that. Now, as you all know, there is a wholesale and a retail aspect of things. Wholesale to retail, there is usually a markup anywhere between 260 to 400%. And I've even seen some situations even higher than that from a wholesale price to a retail price that a consumer may purchase the frames and materials outside of the vision care plan. So that gives you a little bit of an idea in regards to vision, the vision benefit industry, and consumers who are looking to control their costs. Now, over the last several years, as a matter of fact, we started seeing it back in 2012, there has been a whole host of bills that have been introduced throughout many of the states. In fact, there's a federal bill in regards to that. Most of the time, these bills have been pushed by the optometric community and have been very onerous in regards to its impact on the consumer, basically doing away with discounts for non-covered materials, doing away with discounts for non-covered services, eliminating an organization's right to be able to select a lab or an in-network lab for their covered employees. So these bills have been coming up in various states, and I have to admit, they have passed in a few states. And it's been introduced here in the state of Minnesota in years past. We have met many times with the optometrist here locally as well as nationally trying to find that middle ground and have been unable to really find that. But one of the things that have been consistent all the way through that is that they wanted to be reimbursed, or they wanted full reimbursement on non-covered services and materials, and they wanted to make sure that consumers or patients and optometrists, that no one was getting in the way of that patient-doctor relationship. And so that's really what we see that this bill does. Now, I have to admit, we do not agree that we, as a managed vision care plan, could not negotiate for non-covered materials. That is too much of an impact on the consumer. But we felt that our bill did go halfway, and that we are stating in our bill that we will not ask for discounts on non-covered professional services. It's something we disagree with, but we felt that in our bill, in this bill, it goes halfway in regards to that. The other aspects of this is clearly communicating to the consumer what they are getting. And we put the responsibility on us as much as we put it on the provider. If managed vision care plans own a lab or they own a material supplier, we have to disclose that. That has not been required of us in the past. That is included in this bill. If an optometrist needs to or has a relationship and directs someone outside of our network for services and materials, we ask that they disclose that. Let them understand. Make sure the consumer knows what is in network, what is out of network, and what the differential in their payment is as far as that is concerned. So as we look at the bill here, we feel that it does two primary things. It limits our ability in our contracts with our optometrists to where we can no longer ask for discounts on non-covered professional services. But it does leave the rest of the contract up for negotiation. So, and the other aspect of it, and I think is primary, is in regards to the transparency to ensure that not only the optometrist have to communicate clearly to their patients, but also the managed vision care plans to the benefit booklets through their directories and so forth have to communicate anything as it relates to ownership of labs and also any responsibility for going outside of the network. So that's my testimony for today. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee members have.
Members, any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testimony. So I was born with a birth defect such that I don't see out of my right eye. That alters how I look as well. And so I spent a lot of time with ophthalmologists through my whole life. And I noticed the handout information from the optometrist. And I guess I'm wondering, why is it that this is relates to optometrists specifically as opposed to ophthalmologists, or really more broadly other healthcare providers? But even just talking about eyes in particular, why that particular group that I've spent less time with than the other one?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Roberts?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry. Okay. Well, first of all, what we're talking about here is routine vision care plans. There can also be vision care included in your medical plan, but what we're talking to specifically is in regards to routine vision. And the majority of the care that is provided through that is through the optometrist. True, there are also ophthalmologists that do participate in that. Many of the bills that we have been seeing in many of the states have been pushed very heavily by the optometric community and the optometric associations in the various states and nationally, and that's specifically why that states optometry in that bill.
Representative Pinto,
maybe just a quick follow-up. So for ophthalmologists that are working for optometrists, how would this bill then work for them?
Mr. Roberts?
And again, as we have met with the optometrists previously, we had discussed the fact that we'd be happy to expand the definitions within this to include all eye care professionals working within the routine vision care plans. in regards to that. And at this particular time, that tends to be optometrist and ophthalmologist, but with change in scope of practice and so forth, I think it's more important to take a more general definition of eye care professional as it relates to these contracts.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question about line 2.25. What exactly is meant by saying obtain a written confirmation? So would the patient have to sign off on the explanation they got?
Mr. Roberts or Representative Anderson?
With the 2.25, no optometrist shall charge more? I'm sorry, where are we looking at here? Okay. I'm having a written confirmation and understanding from the patient. Yes, so that would be in regards to providing them a written explanation and having them sign off on that, so there's confirmation of that. Correct. I'm sorry, correct.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the testifier, the section E here on, starting on line 2.26. My question is, with regard to, I guess, Vision Care Associates or other plans, are we preventing optometrists from using supplies or labs that are not owned or managed by the plan? I'm trying to understand that section a little bit better.
Basically, what it is, I'm sorry,
nope, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the optometrist recommending an out-of-network supplier, we're stating that, yes, most plans have a lab or a lab network, and most plans have suppliers that they have as part of their benefit plan. We're stating that... The optometrist, if they feel for some reason or another that patient is better suited to utilize another lab or another materials outside of the benefit plan, that they are within their right to do so. We just want to make sure that the consumer is educated in regards to the fact that it is out of network and what the cost differentials will be in regards to that.
And Representative Halverson.
And Mr.
Chair, Representative Anderson.
And it's also to have transparency to the consumer of if there's a financial benefit or interest for the optometrist as well.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the case of a, and so many of these optometrists now might have an in-office lab or have a lab that they work with that may not be part of this particular vision plan, but that they, it seems like people get coverage in other ways. It feels like we're limiting optometrists to very narrow options with regard to who they can service with regard to their patients. I agree with the transparency issue. My question is, do we not have that in other places in law? And I ask that because as a patient, it seems to me that I get very clear guidance in terms of what's covered and what's not in my plan. If it's not in law, it should be, but I do know that state law does require providers to give patients an overview of what their costs are. They are required by law to say, this is what your cost is going to be. This is what our procedures cost. That already exists in state law. So I guess I'm confused about the transparency issue because I feel like it is in state law. And then if we are going to limit optometrists who may have a lab in their office to not be able to use their own lab, I'm wondering what we're doing to these small business owners.
Well, Representative Anderson or Mr. Roberts?
I have to address that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, yes. to answer your question, if you've seen one vision care plan, you've seen one vision care plan. Each vision care plan is different. We have some vision care plans that dictate that you utilize their lab. They actually own a lab, and they have done their rates as far as their premium rates to the marketplace based on the utilization of that lab and those materials. Some do not have a lab that they own, but they have a network of labs. As a matter of fact, in many situations, some of those that have networks of labs, if the optometrist would like to add their lab as part of that, they would be able to do so. There's also vision care plans that are out there that have no requirement to use any particular lab. It's the optometrist's choice in regards to that. So optometrists do have choice in regards to the networks that they contract with, as well as based on the varying natures of those. That helps a vision care plan to determine what their pricing is, and they do their price points depend on what market they are particularly going after. So if they're going after some of the high-end products out there or the low-end products, sometimes you might not be able to get the premiums low enough unless they utilize their own lab for the vision care plan happens to own. If you have one that leaves it up to use whatever lab the optometrist directs them to, those premiums could be a little bit higher and could price some people out of the market. But the issue is each organization is different, and there is choice, and there is competition that exists out there in the market.
Representative Halverson.
Just final question, Mr. Chair. This is I guess I'm trying to continue to figure out the problem that we're trying to solve. The plans that we're talking about in this bill are plans that an individual could purchase to say, I don't have eye coverage, but I want to get a discount on something. Is that correct, as opposed to something like an employer-sponsored plan or something that's provided through a health plan, healthcare plan that provides vision health care coverage as opposed to a discount on services? Is that the two differences that we're talking about?
Well, yes and no. As you look at this, as you dig a little deeper, you learn a little bit more in regards to this. An individual can purchase vision on a standalone basis and strictly a vision policy. Again, usually through their employer, but it's voluntary. If you want it, you buy it. If you don't want it. You can also buy it as a rider to your medical. So it's not really integrated into it, but it's attached to that medical policy. And then there's also situations what we call embedded that are actually embedded into the medical benefits in that regard. So those are the three different ways that you can purchase vision care. The issue is due to the fact that a majority of the vision care benefits are on a voluntary basis, utilization is high. As a matter of fact, it is high because we remind people. We're not like medical where we're trying to prevent utilization. We're trying to encourage utilization because we want them to get in there to get that annual comprehensive exam for two reasons. One, it may be a way to identify early onset of diabetes, other degenerative eye disease that can be found during that examination. That said, at the end of the year, since it's voluntary, if they didn't use their benefits that year, they're going to say, next year, why should I buy it? I didn't use it this past year. I'm not going to buy it this next year. So we're actually an industry that encourages utilization, and you can see with most of the statistics, if they have managed vision care plans, they are more likely to get that annual comprehensive exam than if they don't. It happens more so every 12 months as opposed to every 2 or 3 years if they don't have managed vision care coverage. So we do encourage that utilization and steering them into the offices. And again, regardless of whether the plans, the payment is being done by the vision care plan or by the consumer, we have negotiated discounts on behalf of the consumer to save those out-of-pocket dollars.
We're going to go back to Representative Halverson, and then we've got two more questions for you, and then we're going to bring our next testifier up. Representative Halverson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to continue to get some clarity. So are you saying that the vision care plans that you're here representing provide coverage as a third-party payer for a patient, or are your contracts a discount program that a consumer can go out and buy in order to get a negotiated discount as opposed to third-party payer coverage?
They provide coverage, and they also include discounts in as part of those benefits.
Representative,
so there is a benefit payment included on the annual comprehensive exam and for the first set of frames and lenses or contacts, but there's also discounts negotiated beyond that.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's see, I wrote your name down. Julian, right? Mr.
Yeah,
Roberts?
Absolutely. Okay.
So let's say I have a basic VSP plan and I have a basic frame, basic lenses, right? But let's say I want to upgrade and I don't know, I want a pair of Gucci frames, okay? I understand I'm going to have to pay an extra charge for that, and anything add-ons that may not be included, for example, an anti-reflective glare lens. So is it fair to say with those that you don't want their members to purchase anything outside of your labs, or would I be able to have the option?
With this, you would have the option.
I would still have the option.
Absolutely.
But it would be given as an option, right?
The issue is you have the option to buy within the network or external to the network. But there may only be benefit payment within the network. Now, some vision care plans have out-of-network benefits. Mm-hmm. I don't know specifically in regards to VSP and the policy that you may have in place, but this would give you that option as well as the provider that option if they prefer to steer you outside of network, but also, again, want to make sure that you understand fully what you're getting and what the financial impact would be to you in regards to that.
Representative Franzen, that was the Gucci answer. Did that cover your bases?
No.
Representative Franzen, follow up.
Thank you. So my question is, why can't you have this in a contract instead of having to involve the legislature?
Mr. Roberts.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Representative Franzen, I'm not sure if you were here in the beginning part of this. This issue has been going on at the legislature for about 6 years, mm-hmm. and you've had bills coming from the optometrists, you've had bills coming from the vision care folks, and you're also seeing it on a national level of these two entities kind of fighting about this issue. So this piece of legislation is an attempt to bring the two parties together and get a resolution to this so that we don't have to continue discussing this issue at the Capitol year after year. The example that I gave is the whole two lines of fishing or the mourning dove. How many years did we talk about mourning doves?
You were doing so well, Representative
Anderson. Sorry, I'm bringing up bad memories for Representative Hoppe. So that's the goal and the intent here is to work this out and get a good solution so it doesn't have to come back here to the Capitol.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that leads to my question about messaging about, because there's a lot of opposition to this bill from it's not necessary to it benefits corporations, and I come from South Minneapolis, and it's pretty much there. It's corporate socialism. What I want to know is the harm. You say that if we don't resolve this between two groups, and that happens here at the legislature, there's two groups that are, and it's harming consumers or it's harming business or commerce. So what is it that, what would be the harm if the legislature doesn't act and this has to get resolved outside of here? What is the harm and what is the good that you see that would happen if we pass this bill?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Allen. It's the idea of being able to provide our consumers with greater information so that they can make smart health choices. And so that's where I think about my mother, who's 89 years old, and if she knows that it's going to be out of network, it's going to, you know, potentially cost more, and it might not, it depends, but just giving her a little bit more data on that, I think it's a good first step in this realm. So.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I think with that, we'll bring up Dr. Josh Hannon for our next testifier. Thank you, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you.
Doctors, is it Hannon?
Hannon, yep.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed whenever you're ready.
Thanks. My name's Josh Hannon, and I practice in South Minneapolis with my father. Our clinic's been there for over 40 years, River Lake Clinic. I've been in Minnesota my whole life. I attended St. John's University. Then I actually went to St. Thomas Law School.
Oh,
graduated law.
Man.
the two, St. John's doesn't have a law school yet. But and then I went to Michigan for optometry school and came back here. So I love Minnesota. It's a great place. First of all, I'd like to start with just, it sounds like you had a personal experience, which was poor, so I'm sorry to hear that. I think as a doctor, we always try to explain things well to patients and try to have them understand their coverage level and what's involved. And there's even federal laws that try to encourage that, right, with advanced beneficiary notices where we need to provide notice to patients when something isn't going to be covered. And I understand that it might be helpful to have that notice given, but I think in a lot of cases that notice already is given, and it should have been given. So I'm sorry that it wasn't given to your mother, first of all. I think a lot of the questions that this committee had, the representatives had, are things that I'd like to go back to and kind of work through a little bit. So the reason that the bill pertains only to optometry and not ophthalmology, well, we're both vision care providers. If you're going to pass a law that pertains to vision care, it should pertain to both. The argument that there's optometrists provide more vision care, that's true. There's over three times more ODs in the state of Minnesota optometrists than there are ophthalmologists. Usually ophthalmologists do tend to focus their efforts mostly on surgical eye care, and optometrists provide most of the medical eye care. Well, that's true, but there are some ophthalmologists, and some, as they get to a point where they don't want to do surgery, that, well, they're providing vision care too. They're contracted with these vision care plans. The bill should at least pertain to everybody so it's fair. There's even standalone opticians. That's a person that just does glasses. Well, what about them? They're not even mentioned yet in the hearing. I think, you know, there are other groups here that are involved. And as to the six-year effort, I haven't been involved in much of that. I've been involved more in the meetings lately. But, yeah, there have been efforts to try to clarify on a consumer protection basis and a protection even for optometrists that these are large major corporations, these vision care plans, and they can pass a form contract to us, and we really have very little meaningful opportunity to negotiate any of the terms of that contract. It's either we control this many people that might come to your practice, so you agree to our terms, or you don't. And at least then it's a contractual option. But some of those things where it was covered versus non-covered materials, which that just gets very confusing because these vision care plans are written not in plain language, but often in a lot of legalese. And it's very confusing even for the clinic sometimes, I think, to understand what, say, your mom's coverage is or what the coverage level is. So some of the alternative languages that we've tried to propose to the vision care plans would involve a requirement where they provide both to us and to their member insured, to our patients, something written in plain language that just says, when I decide to get a Gucci frame and I want AR coding and I want protective lenses so my eyes are safe if I get in a crash, what's that going to cost me? Well, what we're given is a thing that's written in code, so I got to find 00 lens category and then figure out what that means. Well, 30 minutes later, I still don't have an answer for you. How frustrating is that? I think a law, if you were ever going to get involved in the legislature in this area, which arguably isn't even necessary. It could be just dealt with on a contractual basis. We'd want something that tells the vision care plans, please tell everybody what your contract really says. What in plain language is covered and not covered, so that I can tell my patients that and everyone can understand. So I think that that would be the first point. The second point I think would be, it seems like Minnesota has been singled out for this, because although other legislation has been done in other states regarding more of that protection piece I was just talking about, not allowing vision care plans to require ODs to take a cut in payment for services or materials that's unfair, those are what other states have tended to pass. It hasn't been something like this. So this is not the language we're talking about in the other states. They perhaps need to look at, too, the impact this would have on the state of Minnesota's economy. There are a lot of Minnesota-based optical laboratories, but as far as we know, there's no vision insurance-owned optical laboratory in the state of Minnesota. So if we were to go forward with this bill, I think the unintended maybe consequence, or maybe intended, depending on how you're looking at it, would be to shuttle business out of the state of Minnesota to other states and other countries where the vision care-owned laboratories would fill these orders. One such laboratory is located in Mexico. If I take my patient's order for glasses and you want your Gucci frames in 2 days, I can get that for you now because my lab's right here in town. But if I have to go through all this and give you a form and have my staff explain all that and have you sign it to get your glasses from the local lab, the practical reality is we're probably not going to have the time to go through all those steps with every patient. So we're just going to send it to the vision insurance plan-owned laboratory that then is going to delay your eyeglasses order by a significant amount of time. And that's why I think you're hearing from a lot of Minnesota optometrists, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Optometric Association. We represent over 500 ODs in the state of Minnesota who all oppose this bill. On the other hand, you don't have any real evidence that any business interest in the state of Minnesota really supports this bill. I haven't heard any evidence that there's any employer that really is in support of this bill here in the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Roberts would know that because he represents all the vision care plans. So if there was such evidence, he would have brought that evidence forward, I'm sure. Instead, you have a gentleman who, Julian's a nice guy and all, but he's representing interests that don't have anything to do with or in any way help the state of Minnesota. So our main opposition to this does have to do with the fact that it doesn't really advance any commercial interests of the state of Minnesota. It doesn't really advance the transparency piece beyond where current law does and beyond where most, and I would say all, optometrists should be having that conversation with their patients. And I think that it also is just discriminatory in its nature that it doesn't pertain to all vision care providers. I think that there have been some alternative languages that have been proposed, and I'm hoping you have copies of some of those. If not, I'm sure Chef, Mr. Harris, could supply those to you. Some of those alternative languages would be more agreeable to us. During our several meetings with the National Vision Care Plans and with that association, we attempted to have those discussions with them about what alternative language might be more agreeable to us, but that unfortunately didn't work. And a lot of that, I think, hinged on what you pointed to in the bill at the end there, those sections that pertain to what lab has to be chosen and how the OD has to notify. That is what they, I think, really kind of want in law, because it makes it so onerous and drives a wedge between the doctor-patient relationship that it causes it to be impractical to have that type of discussion with this extra notice requirement. And with that, I'd like to just open it up to any questions that you may have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, do you want to respond to any of that before we take questions and see if there's anybody else in the audience that wants to speak on this?
Sure, and I can ask Mr. Julian Roberts to join us as well. I just know from my own personal experience with this legislative issue, last session I introduced the piece of legislation, and the guidance that we always receive from the Commerce Committee is that you need to work out your issues and find the peace in the valley. And so around September, I had gotten notification from the optometrist lobbyist that, you know, things aren't working out. So I touched base then with the vision care folks. And the vision care folks said they're not meeting with us. They'd had maybe two meetings up to that point. And following a tradition of the Commerce Committee, I said, you need to go back and you need to figure this out and you need to work together and find a solution to this. So this went on for several months, no meeting, no meeting, no meeting, nothing. So in December, I said, okay, I'm going to sit down with the two groups personally and go through this. So myself and the senator sat down with the two groups to work through it. At that time, I asked repeatedly for new language information from the optometrist of what is it that you're looking for, what changes do you want to have. And that happened over a meeting in December, and then I think that we had two meetings then in January. And when it came time to having the third meeting, it was then canceled by the optometrist. I said, we can meet the following meeting. They said, nope. They keep it the following week. They said, nope, we can't meet. And so it's been really a challenge as far as getting the two groups together to discuss some of these issues. That's kind of the inside baseball of it, and I apologize for taking your time up with that, but just to address the several meetings portion of it. And then as far as filling out the forms and getting notification to the consumer itself. You know, I have a son, and I have to take him for regular doctor's appointments, and I have to fill out about five different forms where I say, yes, I've been notified of this information. So that's something that I do in every doctor appointment, and so I don't see that as an outlier. So, but that's just kind of, you know, from my perspective as a mom, that's what I see going to it. So I don't see that as a hurdle. I would welcome any of meaningful discussion on what the optometrist could see as working through these issues. So, but by meaningful, I mean it has to actually have some language that we can look at so we can work through these things. But if Mr. Roberts wants to add any additional information, I welcome to come forward.
Well, Representative Anderson, I'll add something there. I think we, in this committee, as you pointed out, we do like it when people get together. And we want peace in the valley. And I don't remember the date. I should have looked it up. But I know last year we had this bill calendared, and we pulled it off the agenda. So from a chair's perspective, from a Commerce Committee perspective, we like peace in the valley, but people have to meet. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate the most your statement at the end. And I assume that meetings will happen after today. But the idea that you're willing to work with the other side, and Dr. Hennen, thank you. I appreciate that. And with that, Representative Rosenthal had a question, and then Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the doctor. You said this does two things. One, it'll push business outside of Minnesota.
Correct.
To labs that are located outside Minnesota.
Correct.
And you said this is different than they're doing in other states.
Correct.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. Dr. Hunt. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So in other states, they're doing language more like what we've tried to present during meetings, proposed alternative language, which basically this bill, if you notice as it goes through, it kind of covers non-covered services. What about covered services? Where's the protection for what the vision care plans are going to present to your local optometrist and ophthalmologist in terms of what's covered and what they're actually going to be paying us for that covered materials? That's not in there at all. And it's going to be tough to get them to agree to that, to be honest with you, during meetings. But, I mean, that's what we need in there. So that's what you're seeing in other states. In other states, that version of the bill is being pushed forward, not one that kind of has half of it in there but not the rest. The other piece, the reality is vision care plans seem to be increasing in their ownership of things. They're vertically integrating more. So they're buying up optical laboratories and they're buying up frame companies. And, well, that's part of business, and that's fine. But I think that does create a problem for options You mentioned options, that you wish your mother had better options explained to her. And I think that, unfortunately, the unintended consequence of this is you're limiting options for patients in Minnesota, because the option for me to just fill the script easily on a rush order basis for somebody here at a local Minnesota lab is more limited, to say the least. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Hannon. Mm-hmm. Representative Hillstrom, and then I think we're going to, unless anybody else wants to come down and speak, I think after Representative Hillstrom, maybe we'll let Representative Anderson have the final word, and then we'll move to a vote. I've got a lift coming at 4:45, so we're... Sorry, working ahead a little.
And Representative Slocum, sorry.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think it's clear that I would probably like the other states' proposals and not this one. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Roll call hasn't been requested. Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, ditto. Roll call.
Brevity is our friend. Representative Anderson, we'll give you the final word before we go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the comments that have been said before, for the optometrists, they too can own labs and be vertically integrated as well. And so if you're concerned about that, they could also ship your services out to another state if they so choose. This bill doesn't do this. What this bill does is it says that you have to provide transparency to the consumer. You have to say whether you receive a financial benefit by who you refer your individual to. And it's just a transparency piece. It says this way, as a consumer, you're fully informed that this person has a financial vested interest in sending you to this operator versus sending you to this operator or clinic. And that's what the piece of legislation does here. From my perspective, when I think about my 89-year-old mother, I want to make sure that she's fully informed and that she can know that there's other options out there. We always talk about healthcare as rising costs. Here is a chance to give the consumer the chance to actually be informed and make the right decision so that they're not paying more for healthcare than is necessary. And with that, Mr. Chair, I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson will renew her motion that House File 2779 be referred to the General Register, and a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Poppy.
Aye.
Representative Fenton. Representative Allen.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Davids.
Aye.
Representative Franson. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Oh. Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Loon.
Aye.
Representative Loonan.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
No.
Representative Slocum.
No.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Swizinski.
Aye.
By a vote of 10-8, the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Dr. Hannon, thank you. Nice job. With that, we are looking for Representative Lehman. I thought I heard her pulling up. Representative Slocum, if we have a freshman member who's going to report, I think, have her first bill in front of this committee, and she doesn't have trees and she's not here in time, what do we do about that in Commerce?
Give her a lift.
Yeah. Well, with the lift, Mr. Chair, but who doesn't have their treat? I mean, how did they miss that memo?
I don't know. I think it's my fault. I should have explained more.
I think it's kind of pathetic. And what a way to start a bill.
She was here earlier.
Mr. Chair, is she at the pump and munch?
to get herself some treats to pass out.
Well, you know, we'll take what we can get here. You'd think we dropped enough hints with Representative Anselmo here that she would have picked up on that. But it's nice to have a moment to reflect.
Yeah, it is.
Sometimes. Representative Swidzinski, would you like to move House File 3032 so it is in front of this committee while Representative Lehman makes her way down?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lehman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Isn't there
and committee members. Okay. Well, I'm Representative Sandy Lehman, and
Representative Nash, do you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure that I saw a cart of treats make its way into the room, but I could be mistaken.
I'm assuming it's pulling up shortly.
If only like a ride-sharing could help.
Representative Lehman, to your bill.
Lent works for me. Thank you very much. Well, I'm here today. Just coming off of another committee meeting here. And with me is Matt Patton of Lyft. And before I get going, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, offers amendment to offer.
Okay. Is that the A1 amendment?
That is the A1 amendment.
My apologies. I should have mentioned that. I will go ahead and move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lehman, to your bill.
Okay.
Or I'm sorry, are we moving to Mr. Patton? Are you?
No.
Okay. Just
some introductory comments. I'm here today to talk about creating uniform statewide standards for Lyft. Lyft has been in the state of Minnesota since 2014. And since that time, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans have had the opportunity to ride Lyft, and tens of thousands of folks have served as drivers. But primarily, Lyft has provided service in the metropolitan area, and I'm interested, as a greater Minnesota legislator, in providing the opportunity for greater Minnesota to catch up and have the opportunity to also have this great service. Transportation in greater Minnesota is a real obstacle in a lot of ways. If you are disabled, if you are elderly, if you are without a car, you are looking for other opportunities that aren't currently available. If you're a tourist coming to a resort and you want to get into town, these kinds of opportunities are beneficial. I'm a rider of Lyft here in the Twin Cities, and I like it for several reasons. One is, as a woman, I feel safe. There's no cash changing hands. There's no misunderstanding about the price. You know your price right up front. There's no plan to take a longer route and then drive up the costs. You know you've seen the picture of your driver before he or she arrives at the door. For all of those reasons, there's more security and more safety, really, for driving. In rural communities, I see it as an economic opportunity. It's an economic opportunity here right now. Most of the drivers are entrepreneurs or folks with other jobs, and this is an additional income for them. And then, as I said, I see it as an opportunity to increase transportation options for rural. So I'm here today to just provide my energy and excitement about this opportunity for uniform standards in the state of Minnesota. But I'd like to have Matt from Lyft go over the details of the bill with you today.
Mr. Patton, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Representative. Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for considering this bill before you today. As Representative said, I'm Matt Patton. I'm the Midwest Public Policy Manager for Lyft. We're the first ride-sharing company to establish peer-to-peer on-demand ride-sharing since 2014. Today, we're the fastest ride-sharing company in the United States. Simply download and register the application on your smartphone, and from then on, requesting a ride happens with just the push of a button. But we're more than just a safe ride to work, home, or doctor appointment. We're a service that allows people to be their own boss, gives them flexibility in their schedule, and the opportunity to earn supplemental income. The bill before you today attempts to codify what we already do into law in order to avoid a patchwork for inconsistent regulations, and more importantly, so we can bring more services into your state. Lyft's number one priority is safety. Our drivers are extensively pre-screened, have passed through driver record review and in-person evaluations, in addition to having their vehicle pass a comprehensive 19-point vehicle inspection. That focus on safety and security continues throughout the Lyft experience. Every ride is protected by Lyft's $1.5 million commercial automobile liability coverage, which protects riders and drivers throughout the ride. 45 other states have similar laws. In those states, we're able to offer services like Lyft Line, which is an option commuters use to accept rides on their way to work. 20% of our rides are commuter sharing rides, reducing traffic and saving money. Without a uniform statewide ride-sharing regulation, like the one before you today, a patchwork of local regulation stands as a barrier for drivers and riders who otherwise could be sharing a ride to work from their home in the suburbs to their office in the Twin Cities. Already, Lyft rides have generated an estimated $26 million into Minnesota's economy, and with the current insurance statute you approved a couple of years ago, Minnesota is primed to adopt the statewide set of regulations for ride-sharing and continue to do its part to grow jobs and keep your economy running strong. Simply put, the bill before you works in 45 states, and Lyft is excited to bring all that we offer to your residents, your economy, and hopefully continue to make getting from here to there just a little bit easier. With that, thank you for letting me testify today. I'm happy to answer your questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. And before we go to questions, I think we should acknowledge the Senate author of the bill who's here, Senator Jasinski. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. With that, members, any questions for the author? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to get some clarification, why is it that you chose to go this way for regulation instead of including them, like, in the same regulation that we use for taxi cab drivers?
Mr. Patton?
Sure. This act only affects ride-sharing companies. We welcome, you know, consideration of a taxi license or a bill that would change their requirements if they so chose to bring that up for debate.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, these aren't the same restrictions that we place on taxi cab drivers, and so I'm curious as to why you have lesser restrictions to provide ride shares than we put on taxi cab drivers.
Sure. Well, 90% of our drivers drive less than 20 hours a week, and this, just governed by statute, is a separate ride-sharing piece of legislation that governs TNC vehicles, not taxis.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to look up all of these criminal statutes, but I'm curious as to why on line 4.25 you only prohibit the folks who are on national sex offender websites and not just Minnesota-registered sex offenders.
Mr. Patton?
Sure. Our background check is, as I just outlined in the bill, and if there's a point of discussion that, you know, yourself or stakeholder would be willing to have about it, this is the beginning point of that discussion, and we're open to those ideas.
Representative Hillstrom, you're kind of veering into civil law territory, but I miss being on that committee, so this is kind of fun. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, Mr. Chair, and I would think that we would want our consumers to be protected and consider Minnesota's sex offender registry, not just the national sex offender registry, for example, as a consumer protection.
Mr. Patton?
Sure. Again, I think something that would come up in further committees, we're open to continuing that discussion about our background checks.
Representative Hillstrom, is that, do you want to work with Representative Lehman and see if we can make that happen?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to look up the rest of these and see what else I can find.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Members, other questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and interesting discussion. I have a question regarding the position of the League of Cities or other local government entities regarding the local
Representative Halverson, we're going to have Ann Finn from the League of Cities is up next. Do you want to?
Then I will ask
Okay,
her.
Perfect.
Thank you.
With that, Ms. Finn, if you're here, do you want to come up and Representative Halverson, do you want to ask your question first, or do you want to wait and see if she answers it in her general testimony? Will you?
I will wait, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Finn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And before I get into the testimony that I prepared, I just wanted to clarify one thing that was presented in the presentation of the bill. And that is that this bill would somehow help Greater Minnesota get more access to the ride-sharing networks or the transportation network companies. And as it stands, nothing in current law prohibits them from operating in Greater Minnesota. It's simply that there are cities that haven't adopted ordinances and counties that haven't adopted ordinances that would regulate them. The League of Minnesota Cities opposes House File 3032 because it interferes with local decision-making authority. We specifically object to Section 3, Subdivision 12, which preempts local ordinances. The proponents of this legislation have not initiated one conversation about this bill with us, and we would have liked the opportunity to have that conversation, any conversation, before the bill was dropped. And given the significance of the public policy changes being proposed, we believe a logical next step would be to convene a meeting of stakeholders, including local government representatives. To be clear, we do not oppose regulation of the transportation network industry. We simply think that the locals should be consulted and that some level of local control should be authorized. The League is willing to work with industry representatives and other stakeholders to craft policy that balances the interests of the TNCs, local policymakers, and customers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Finn. Why are cities not drafting? I mean, do they not know Uber and Lyft exist?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cresha, they don't have to have an ordinance. There's nothing that requires them it's a relatively new industry. And so the cities that have seen a lot of activity by the industry have taken the route of adopting ordinances because they want to make sure that their constituents and the folks that use the services are safe. But nobody has to have one. And right now, we only know of a handful that have them.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to the testifier. So just, my experience has been that when there's uncertainty, companies may not move in as quickly. And so by taking away that uncertainty, it would seem, and it already seems like if there is certainty out there, that these companies are moving in there. So it would seem that the cities could do themselves a favor by reducing the uncertainty.
Ms. Finn?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cresha, that may be true. And to that end, we would be willing to sit down with the industry folks and figure out what works. But to this point, no one has come to the League or the other city groups to ask for any kind of input.
Thank you. And Representative Halverson, did you get your question answered, or are we? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Ms. Finn answered my initial question. However, I'm curious with regard to the local ordinances that exist now. Are there anything that Lyft or any of these ride-sharing organizations are objecting to in specific, or is this more of a boilerplate, we just want one statewide ordinance and we don't want cities to weigh in?
Ms. Finn or Mr. Patton or both of you?
We'd
like
to
work together.
Representative Halverson, I think I would defer to the proponents of the bill to answer that question.
Mr. Patton.
Sure, Representative, thanks for your question. Just quickly clarify, too, we have already engaged meetings with local stakeholders. Those discussions are beginning. But to answer your question, this then related to that answer is the beginning of discussion, and we're definitely seeking input from all stakeholders involved, cities, partners, everyone included. And this is the first point of discussion. We're all open to continuing it for sure.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm glad that this is just the beginning of the discussion. I often say when it comes to preempting local ordinances, my city regularly gets a 95-96% approval rating from our citizens. The legislature tends to get a lower approval rating. So I'm always it always makes sense to me to make sure that I'm involving my cities. My city are very popular with our citizens. And so it sounds like this is more an initial boilerplate language. I think that we need to perhaps look at what cities have already proposed and already put in place and get more information on that. Thank you, Representative Lehman, for starting the discussion. Thank you for not saying it's a simple bill. It's always the kiss of death for a new bill, right? And so it sounds like you are willing to do a lot of work on this. I think it obviously needs some work, and so I hope that we can work on the local issue.
Representative Lehman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, I think you have a pretty accurate assessment of the situation. I've had an opportunity to speak to the League of Minnesota Cities and other stakeholders, and even those who are maybe here in opposition are not here in total opposition. I mean, they get it, and they understand what we're attempting to do and just want to be part of the discussion.
I think, Mr. Ranieri, are you ready to come down and we can hear from the City of Minneapolis? Thank you, Ms. Finn. Mr. Ranieri, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a way to have you?
Please identify yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. With me today is Mr. Grant Wilson, who's our Director of Regulatory Services and does an awful lot of work in this area with Lyft and Uber. Mr. Chairman, back in 2014, before I start, I want to add something to the record. Mr. Chairman, there are Minneapolis-St. Paul and the Airport Commission in 2014 adopted ordinances. But most recently, in the last couple of months, Rochester, St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth, and Moorhead have Uber and Lyft in their communities, and most of those communities have adopted ordinances. So we're seeing movement into greater Minnesota, and we're also seeing activity with Uber in our Twin City suburbs, even though there aren't very many ordinances in the suburbs. Back in 2014, this was a fairly new issue, how to work with rideshare. So we worked with Uber, Lyft, taxi cab drivers, most of our stakeholders, to try and craft an ordinance that worked for them and encourage and basically encouraged and public safety and helped with consumer protection. We came up with an ordinance that we think had basic rules to allow for oversight and to do things that we think would help the industry work, but at the same time protect our citizens. Our ordinance had, and when you compare it to the statute being proposed, there are some concerns. We have in our ordinance a require for an inspection of a vehicle. That inspection must be done by a certified mechanic. We have a form that must be filled out, and it must be done annually. This bill requires also an inspection, but prior to putting the car in service, and there is no language talking about an annual inspection. And that's a concern of ours for safety's sake. In addition, our ordinances and many of the other ordinances around the state require that the car be no more than 10 years old in terms of model year terms. This proposal does not have that 10-year limit. And it's another thing we're concerned about that should be looked at. This proposal also suggests that we would be preempted, and I think Ms. Finn talked about page 7. Also on page 2 or page 1 in section 2, that definition that excludes transportation network companies from being a or being defined as a small vehicle service company is important because in the amendment, the section that's being changed, 221, section 221, there is a provision in section 221.091 that says cities can regulate by ordinance small vehicle service companies. Since TNCs are excluded from that definition, there would be not be in the future any ordinances by cities governing TNCs, and that's a concern. Another concern is this bill talks about being able to allow, I think in Section 6, Subdivision 6, allowing police officers to request to look at the platform, the electronic platform, to make sure that the ride share is legit, that the person who's in the car has asked for the ride and is on the machine. So in other words, you can't hail. One of the things is, in our ordinances and many other ordinances, the ride shares can't, Uber drivers or Lyft drivers cannot stop, just pick anyone off the street who is trying to hail a cab. I know in Minnesota that's not a big activity, but we know in New York and other cities that's happening. Under our ordinance, we allow these inspectors to call for Uber and Lyft and then do an inspection to determine that they are in compliance with our ordinance. I'm going to get this wrong. What do we call our dress? The little
trade dress.
Our trade dress, which means that on the front of the car and the back of the car, there must be a insignia saying that this is an Uber or Lyft car or TNC, so people can know that that's their car, and when we drive up, get picked up, they can see it. We also do a check to see that the inspection report and the insurance information is either on the platform or in the car. Now, when we started doing this, there were lots of slip-ups and violations because it was new. But as we've gone along, we've seen dropping down to low teens from very high numbers. So it's going down. We are concerned about those kinds of items, those kinds of issues. We're willing to work with the author on this, but at this point we need to be opposed to as it is drafted now.
Mr. Ranieri, thank you, and thank you especially for saying you'd be willing to work with the author. I think I'm assuming that noise I can hear is furious note-taking. So I appreciate that. And Mr. Wilson, do you have anything to add to that?
Representative Hoppe, thank you. Grant Wilson, City of Minneapolis. Just one comment. The City of Minneapolis ordinance has a unique program where we charge a surcharge to every taxi cab in the city and every TNC company, a fee that's on top of their license fee that we put into an incentive fund for wheelchair taxi cabs. Because of that program, the City of Minneapolis has 32 fully wheelchair accessible taxi cabs because of the program. If we're preempted and not being able to collect a license fee, I don't see that that's going to continue to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And to that point, our next testifier will be Mr. Richard Cervantes, and then I think we're going to have Mrs. Wilshire from the Council on Citizens with Disabilities. So I'm sure she will be bringing that point up as well. Mr. Cervantes, thank you, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ricardo Cervantes. I'm the director of the Department of Safety and Inspections with the City of St. Paul. Forgive me if I have some of the similar points that were made by Mr. Ranieri, but I do want to say that St. Paul is open to new and innovative ways of improving services and supporting a vibrant and strong business community. The Department of Safety and Inspections is charged with protecting the health and safety of its residents and visitors. As Mr. Ranieri said, St. Paul was one of the partners in 2013 and 2014 that worked in cooperation with several metro cities, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, the Met Council, and we even presented to state representatives, as well as the TNC industry, to enact a well-thought-out, fair, reasonable, and effective ordinance that provide protection for passengers and drivers of TNC services. These laws have been developed into practices that have proven to be effective in the City of St. Paul. Prior to today, representatives from Lyft did reach out to the City of St. Paul to discuss the House File 3032, and we did have an opportunity to discuss, to weigh in on the bill and also voice our concerns. During that review of the bill, it came apparent to us that we needed to better understand how the state would implement and administer these new laws. The bill does not contain specific language as to who will be responsible to ensure compliance of the proposed regulations, what enforcement systems will be used to gain that compliance, or how the state will appropriate enough funding to administer these regulations. In addition to these larger questions, we had concerns regarding language in the bill that diminishes safety and creates an unfair competitive advantage for TNCs. The proposed language appears to allow folks that are still serving a sentence or may even be incarcerated to qualify as TNC drivers, depending on the sentencing and severity of the crime. The proposed language provides vague vehicle inspection requirements and establishes no standards, such as St. Paul and Minneapolis and MAC. Limiting license fees will result in inadequate resources for the state, eliminating the staff necessary to actually conduct the compliance checks. Preempting local regulations of TNCs and implementing the proposed bill would create an unfair competitive advantage for TNCs over the primary competitors under the proposed bill. The regulatory cost of a TNC vehicle would be approximately $1. Based on the fees that are being proposed in the bill. By comparison, St. Paul charges $420 for a taxi cab license. And the state of Minnesota charges $80 for a limousine license. Finally, this bill has no mileage or age limits for its TNC vehicles, which would further disadvantage taxi cab operators as well as jeopardize public safety. The City of St. Paul has serious concerns with the bill and believes there are other ways to gain regulatory uniformity. We are certainly willing to meet with our partners and stakeholders as we had when we developed the original ordinances for the various cities within the metro area, as well as the author, to come up with a solution in regards to coming up with a solution for the TNCs in more uniform regulations throughout the state. I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Cervantes, thank you. Members, any questions? We got a number of other people that want to come and speak. And Ms. Wilshire, if you want to come down. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. We're one of the state's advisory committees, and we specialize in a variety of areas, but certainly transportation is a huge area for people with disabilities. First off, I applaud on wanting to expand transportation options in greater Minnesota. We get a lot of calls in our office about there's just no transportation out there in the rural areas. But I want to make you aware of some of the unintended consequences of this bill. The license fees the City of Minneapolis collects from Uber and Lyft enable the city to start a wheelchair-accessible taxicab program, as you just heard. Minneapolis now has 32 wheelchair-accessible taxicabs operating for on-demand taxi services in Minneapolis. So what this means for people with disabilities, people don't have to rely on Metro Mall. That's a four-day wait. How many in here in the room have to wait 4 days to go to the grocery store, to go to church? I don't think anyone here would have to wait that long. So, you know, this service is something that's really needed in the disability community. I encourage Uber and Lyft to be part of the solution. And if they are not able to provide wheelchair-accessible rides, then they should make sure other providers can do so. Bottom line is, people with disabilities need to be able to live, work, and play in our own communities of our choice. and the on-demand accessible transportation is a must. That's all I have.
That was nicely done, Ms. Wilshire. Thank you. Members, any questions? I heard more furious note-taking while you were speaking, so thank you very much. With that, Mr. Stephen Huser from the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. Welcome, sir. Please state your name for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Huser. I'm with Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents the shared interests of cities in the seven-county metro area at the legislature, executive branch, and the Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities respectfully opposes House File 3032, specifically the Section 3, Subdivision 12 that was mentioned earlier. These provisions contradict Metro Cities' policies supporting local authority and allowing municipalities to decide their own local ordinances. Paragraph B of that subdivision would have the effect of nullifying ordinances that have already been enacted by cities. So I'll keep it brief since I've just kind of rehashed what a lot of other city advocates have said. And I would also say that Metro Cities looks forward to working with the advocates on this bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
It's almost like you know what we like to hear. Nice job testifying. Mr. Waleed Sambal from Blue Oi Taxi. And then we'll finish up with Allison Grubner from Commerce, the Department of Commerce. Welcome to the committee, and welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready.
I'll start. Okay. Mr. Chair, Nancy Hilden, and I'm here with Mr. Sambal. Mr. Sambal is the minority owner and operator of the largest taxicab company in the state of Minnesota, actually. And that's important because what you're contemplating doing with this bill has a great impact on how competition works amongst commercial exchanges of rides. And so with that, I just want to introduce Mr. Sambal and let him say his piece.
Hello, Chair, members, and staff. Thank you for having me. My name is Wally Sambal, as you told you. I had a lot of stuff to say, but I'm going to address some things I've heard today because apparently I understand this Lyft bill more than Lyft people do. First of all, this bill is not the same bill passed in 45 states across the country. This is the base of the bill, but in a lot of the states there are a lot more requirements and a lot more demands of T&Cs than this bill states. So I want to make sure we're clear that this is not the bill in 45 different states. We're talking about safe rides. Taxi drivers have to go through a series of safety things to do. So one of the things they have to do, for example, is a background study. Now, it's not just a fingerprint background check once a year. It's an ongoing background check, meaning it's supervised. And every 3 years, they have to reapply for that supervision for them to do transportation. That means if they get hit with a penalty or a criminal act, we know about it, and so does the state. We also supervise their driving records. Most drivers, before they even find out themselves that their driving records are suspended, we know, and we're able to take them off the streets. There has been numerous fines across the country for Uber and Lyft for not complying by their own laws that they have set forth. And so recently in the state of Star and Tribune, there was a story about Uber and Lyft, and 30% of the 176 drivers did not comply with Uber and Lyft's own standards of safety. They had numerous drivers where they were hailing, and this goes across the country, where their drivers are caught asking for cash from people on the street. And there is no insurance under that law that protects those people in those cars. And so that has been documented and is well known that it happens. I think these things are really important to address when we talk about this. If we're going to protect consumers, and consumer protections is very important, I think it's very important that those standards, those gold standards that people have gotten used to and expect, should be kept in place. We have apps too. In fact, the Minneapolis Public Radio did a comparison of our apps, and our pricing is very much in line with Lyft and cheaper than UberX. We were almost definitely on time the same day we're on time, too, in the same amount of time. My point is the app is not innovation. The apps have been around before they even came around, and we have an app, and everybody else has an app. But we strive to do better and strive to protect the consumer, and I think that should be something that's regarded as very important. For talking about safety, That's safety. We have cameras in our cars. We initiated that. And if we can do that, then why should there be somebody who says, well, we want to do more, but we want you to make let us do less also. And they haven't even complied with their own laws. And I know we're short on time, so I'm not going to go, because I can go on forever.
Well, we appreciate that, Mr. Sommel, and thank you for your testimony and for your comments about what was said earlier. We appreciate it.
Ms. Holden. If I could just draw the committee's attention to this comparison chart. This shows some of the regulatory requirements that are currently on the books for cab companies, and the X means it's not required under this proposal that's before you. So it's in your packet.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. With that, Ms. Grubner from Commerce. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Allison Grubner, Director of Government Affairs at the Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comments on the bill. I'll be quick. I don't want to be in between you all and the door. So first and foremost, the department supports economic growth, transportation options for folks, safety and consumer protections, all of which I know the proponents of the bill really emphasize. This bill, however, raises serious questions that we just had the opportunity to raise with the proponents of the bill this morning. The department believes this bill requires significantly more stakeholder conversations to better understand what the proponents are seeking to achieve and how best we can accomplish those outcomes. Just a couple of the department's concerns on the bill in front of you is the bill creates a licensing scheme without articulating licensing standards. How is this regulatory framework to be enforced? How complaints from consumers or companies will be addressed by the department? And then questions around technology, staff costs, and IT needs. The department has serious concerns about the bill, but we look forward to working with all stakeholders to get the bill into a place that we can support. Thanks for your opportunity to provide feedback.
Thank you, Ms. Grubner. Members, any questions for Ms. Grubner, any of the testifiers? And just to clarify, I don't know if I said this in my original motion, but this bill is going to be re-referred to civil law. And I think every one of the testifiers has said they're willing to work with the authors of the bill. And I think the author has said that she's willing to work with people. I think this is what we call a work in progress. And Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think it's been laid out pretty clearly that the requirements for taxi cab drivers are not anywhere near the requirements that are proposed in this bill. And I have serious concerns about the background check provisions, and I'm glad that it's going to civil law. If it makes it out of this committee, I assume it will. But, Mr. Chair, it's not clear to me. Most of the background check requirements in this provision, the way I read it, would require felony-level offenses, not necessarily your assaults that are misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor-level offenses. We have requirements. We don't allow people to deal with vulnerable adults and people who are disabled, and they have certain disqualifying offenses, and sometimes those are lifetime bans. That doesn't take any of that into account in this particular provision. And it's not even clear to me. We allow people to get their driver's license back if they're currently on a sentence for a DWI, but they have ignition interlock. And it's not clear to me, under the way this is written, that that would be a disqualifier from somebody while they're on the ignition interlock because of an active DWI offense that they would be precluded. And so I think, Mr. Chair, as people have raised issues, there are some serious concerns with this. And I would think, Mr. Chair, at least you would want Minnesota sex offenders to be included, not just nationally registered sex offenders.
Ms. Representative Hillstrom, I think when you were talking about this earlier, and if this weren't already going to be re-referred to civil law, I would have had that idea. And I think that noise that we have heard frequently, and I think you just heard while you were speaking, is the proponents of the bill, the people working on it, to take a lot of notes. I think there are a lot of things. I think everybody expressed a willingness to work on it. I think all of these problems are solvable, but I think it's going to take people coming together. I don't know when it's going to be in civil law, but I have a funny feeling that you and probably Representative Pinto and others will have a lot of questions. And I think the folks from Lyft and the authors know that there are some issues that need to be addressed, and thank you for bringing those up. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Given the testimony of the recent testimony about from the owner of the taxicab company, I guess I wanted to kind of build on what Representative Hellstrom brought up again and allow the gentleman from Lyft to respond. I just don't understand why taxicabs would be regulated differently than transportation network companies. As I look through our statutes, it's all the same once they've got the app and everything else, with the exception being that the cars are called taxicabs, and once they're taxicabs, it's separated. So can you provide some justification for why we're looking at the one when there's such higher standards for taxicabs?
Mr. Patton.
Sure. The short answer is, I mean, our regulation proposed today is something that would govern transportation network company vehicles. There are certain differences between transportation network company vehicles and taxicabs. One of them being the obvious one is that they're personal vehicles also. And our drivership only works, 90% of our drivers work less than 20 hours a week. So the part-time nature of our drivers and the ownership of vehicles is one difference. Given the concerns that were raised today by the taxicabs, we're open to having any and all discussions on any concerns with this bill.
Okay. Representative Pinto. Okay. And I think to kind of follow up on that, I mean, this we're talking about essentially maybe not duplicating, but doing something very similar statewide for what we've done for Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I think these are solvable problems. We get people together and work these things out, we can address a lot of these concerns. So with that, any other questions, members? Representative Lehman will give you the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we heard today is, as you said, there's lots of room for discussion. We're at the beginning of that discussion right now. But what I'm really pleased is that I didn't hear anybody say that there's no cause to work towards some good uniform standards for this industry that we can all live with. And that's what we're here to start the ball rolling in that direction today, and I look forward to working with everyone that spoke today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. And with that, Representative Swedzinski renews his motion that House File 3032, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, everybody who spoke for and against the bill. Good discussion. And members, with that, I think since we went through our agenda, we will not be meeting tomorrow. Have a good evening. Thank you.